Happy New Year, and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for January 7th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, sexual ornamentation in butterflies, early human migration out of North Africa, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about fighting global climate change by eating bugs, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
One of the most common sexual ornaments occurs in birds, with males sporting bright plumage and females in more drab colors. The males court and the females choose. But there are lots of species in which both sexes have sexual ornaments, especially among insects. And there are several explanations for how these mutual sexual ornaments evolved. It could be genetic correlation, same-sex competition, mutual mate choice, a combination of one or more of these, or even something else. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Kathleen Prudick and colleagues report that different temperatures at critical periods of development are enough to change the sexual roles, courting or choosing, of the African butterflies Bicyclus ananana. The research suggests that the sexual role reversal in different seasons, warm and cool times of the year, may have resulted in the mutual sexual ornamentation. The research also could challenge previous assumptions about how sexual ornaments developed in the first place in other species, too. I spoke with Prudick from her office at Yale University.
We found that sexual signals in butterflies can be controlled by environmental temperature that they experience as caterpillars. So much of biology thinks about sexual ornaments, these glorious visual signals that animals display when they are trying to attract a mate. Commonly, we think that the males display and then the females choose. And oftentimes, this leads to beautiful male ornaments and boring, drab female ornaments. However, there's many species, especially in insects, where both males and females are brightly colored or heavily ornamented. We don't really understand why that is. And a new hypothesis that we came up with was that sexual role reversals could happen based on changes in the developmental temperature of the young caterpillars. So a caterpillar reared at a certain temperature would display a certain sexual role. So if a caterpillar was reared under warm conditions, the females chose while the boys courted. If a caterpillar was reared under cooler conditions, the males chose and the females courted.
What are the ornaments in particular that varied between these warmer temperature reared butterflies and the cooler temperature reared butterflies?
So the ornaments are something we call a wing eye spot. So it is a series of concentric rings of color. On the outside in this species, you've got like an orange ring, and then inside it's a darker, like a brown. And then in the middle is something we call the pupil, which is white to us, but is actually reflecting in the UV as well. And so insects and birds and reptiles can see them, but we cannot.
And so how did you and your team go about investigating the role of these ornaments?
Well, we set up a series of behavioral experiments where we would eliminate the eye spot and then look at things like courtship behavior and mate preference behavior. And then we would also look at the different temperature reared forms. So we had this really nice nested design where you would, you know, rear the same eggs at different temperatures or the eggs from the same female at different temperatures and then compare whether courtship and mate preference changed.
So you had both the cooler temperature reared butterflies as well as the warmer temperature reared butterflies, males and females of both.
Correct.
What then besides courtship? If anything, did you and your team find about mating preference based on these ornaments, these spots?
So both males in the cool season temperature and females in the wet season preferred the UV pupil intact. So they preferred to have that part of the eye spot available for them to see. And they would choose mates with that characteristic, with that sexual ornament. Also, the size of the sexual ornament and its UV reflectance, meaning the amount of light, UV light it reflected back at the observer, changed based on whether that sex was the courting sex or not. So if the sex was the courter, then it had a much brighter eye spot, so it would be more conspicuous. So it seems like sexual monomorphism to us in many ways, but it actually may be sexual dimorphism to them.
Because of the increased reflectivity.
Right, exactly. So it's a much brighter, more conspicuous trait.
So these ornaments changed and the males and females switched sexual or courtship roles based on whether they were raised in the lab equivalent to the warm season or the lab equivalent to the cool season.
Exactly.
Did the cost of courtship, the energy expended by the male or female butterfly, what, if any, differences in courtship costs were there?
Yeah, we didn't measure really any costs in courtship. What we did measure was costs in mating. So insects, or many insects, give what they call a nuptial gift besides just that package of sperm to the female. And it's often called a spermatophore. So it's this packet of extra nutrients or maybe some chemical defenses or something like that. And the dry season males or the cool season males seem to give a greater gift. So it affected their longevity. So if they mated, they were more likely to die than the wet season males. And likewise, the females that received that nuptial gift from dry season males lived longer than if they mated with a wet season male.
Have you and your team found what leads to this longer female longevity when mating with a dry season male?
No, we have not. That remains to be discovered. There's some hypotheses out there. It may change maybe a hormone, so it may be a signal to the female, and it changes the way she metabolizes fat or acquires nutrients herself. It could also be just a water gift maybe as well, because these critters, in these cool season conditions, there's not very many adult resources available at all.
So you deprived the females of water as well in this experiment?
We deprived them of nectar mostly. They did have water available. In another experiment, it's not published in this paper, but we gave them no water, and it did increase longevity as well.
Did it have any effect on the number of eggs that the females laid
at
all?
Yes, it does. So a female that mates with a dry season male lays more eggs than a female who mates with a wet season male.
So the female lives longer and lays more eggs.
Correct. It's hard to tell whether that's just a consequence of living longer or if there's actually some additional addition of nutrients. We weren't able to untangle those two components.
Is that what you're working on next?
Actually, what I'm working on next is looking at the same eye spots that are used for mating can also be used for predator avoidance. So I'm looking at the interaction between mating and predator avoidance.
For this paper, then, is this kind of switching in sexual roles unique, at least in literature, to this species of butterfly?
So one of the problems of that, yes, it has not been described before, but as near as I can tell, no one else has looked in this way. So there's several species of butterflies that have been shown in a single sex to switch their mating behavior. But oftentimes those studies didn't look at the opposite sex as well. So it's novel in that regard, is that we looked at both males and females through development.
Does this research then suggest that sexual ornamentation and reciprocal sexual selection may occur in other species, but perhaps on longer timescales than just seasons?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question for somebody who has a much longer lived organism. So the butterflies tend to live only, you know, anywhere from a couple months to a couple weeks as adults. So it seems like a more natural system for that to be involved in. You know, invertebrates, you could see it happening, although their sexual behavior, I think, is much more dynamic, perhaps, than invertebrates, just because they live for so much longer. Well, I think the exciting thing is how interesting insect mating behavior is. I mean, I think many people, and I'm among them some days, think that insects are kind of simple creatures that have these very kind of boring lives. But in fact, they're very dynamic and very engaging, and I think we can learn a lot from them about processes that happen in vertebrates and other animals.
So this is a start to start looking at other species, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And thinking maybe some of the assumptions we made about other species may be incorrect, and insects might give us a window into challenging some of those assumptions.
Katie Prudick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Katie Prudick of Yale University is lead author of a paper on how developmental plasticity in the sexual roles of a butterfly species drives mutual sexual ornamentation. If you look at a map of Africa, it's immediately clear that any of our ancestors who left the continent tens of thousands of years ago had to travel through North Africa to do so. Boats just hadn't been invented yet. Prior studies suggested that the early modern humans who migrated out of Africa were sub-Saharan or from Eastern Africa. But as science contributing correspondent Michael Balter reports in this week's issue, there's growing evidence that our ancestors actually migrated out of North Africa, spreading at least their culture both to South Africa and north, to today's Middle East, Europe, and beyond. I caught up with Balter, who is traveling in Australia.
Researchers have known or been pretty sure for a long time that modern humans, that is our species, Homo sapiens, first arose in Africa about 200,000 years ago, but it's still a question where in Africa. The genetics seems to point to sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly East Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, and so forth, and that is where we find the earliest specimens. So that picture is looking pretty good, but the question of where the modern humans that left Africa in various kind of out-of-Africa waves, where in Africa they came from, is still unresolved. And there's some new evidence. It's certainly not conclusive, but it's suggestive that at least some of the populations that left Africa beginning at least 100,000 years ago were in North Africa. And that's a bit of a paradigm shift if it's correct, because the modern genetics has tended to point to sub-Saharan Africa as the origin for these out-of-Africa populations.
So with these waves that left Africa, the scientific consensus is that modern humans left several times or came from different parts of Africa or what?
Well, the picture up until recently was that there were about two waves, one about 100,000 years ago, maybe as early as 130,000 years ago, depending on the dating, which is uncertain. And that would be a wave that went into the Levant, in other words, modern-day Israel, Syria, Jordan, especially Israel, where we have actual skeletons and evidence of modern humans having gotten out that early. But it's not clear whether or not that wave led to anything else or went any further in Eurasia, in Europe, or in Asia. What is more certain is that beginning sometime between 50,000 and 70,000 years ago, there was at least one more wave that was successful, and that leads to the so-called Upper Paleolithic in Europe, that leads to modern humans across Asia into China, and eventually as far as Australia. But there is the possibility, and some of the genetic and fossil evidence is beginning to suggest, and archaeological evidence too, is beginning to suggest that there might have been even additional waves later on, say about 30,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago. Researchers are still kind of sorting that out, but it's beginning to look that way.
How long do scientists think these migrations took?
Well, that's a really good question to which there's kind of no clear answer. The genetics appears to indicate that they were fairly quick, that they were within kind of maybe windows of opportunity that were provided by changes in the climate. One of the things that we talk about in the story is the fact that at particular fairly discrete time periods, lasting maybe at most several thousand years, that the Sahara Desert was really quite wet rather than being so barren and dry as it is today, and that early modern humans were actually able to traverse it and to get out of Africa. And it does appear that there is some correspondence between the waves that we see in the archaeological record and the fossil record and the dating of those episodes, and times when the Sahara was fairly passable. There were rivers, there were lakes.
So it's not as if there was necessarily a long period of time in which these populations were in North Africa and were evolving there.
Well, that's the interesting thing that's new, and that is that what's not been clear, and still really is not totally clear, is how many different populations from different parts of Africa might have made up or been part of these out-of-Africa migrations. Now, previously, until very recently, it was thought that the North Africans had very little to do with this. And the reason for that was that the radiocarbon dating of sites in North Africa that belonged to a culture called the Aterian, which is characterized by very sophisticated stone tools and arrowhead-looking projectile-type points, the Aterian and this North African occupation had only begun about 40,000 years ago. But with new dating techniques, it's now clear that the Aterian culture goes back at least 145,000 years ago. And there's even earlier evidence for the existence of modern humans, or at least very early modern humans, in North Africa. So the new picture that we're getting now is that the North Africans may very well have been, at least, at the very least, an important part or an important population, together with other populations from other parts of Africa that got out of Africa early, including in these multiple waves.
So scientists knew that these Aterians, these populations, died in North Africa, but not whether they also spread out of North Africa. Is that right?
Well, what we knew is that beginning about 40,000 years ago, those human populations had a very significant presence in North Africa for a period of maybe 10 to 20,000 years. That's the old picture. And it was not thought, because of what appeared to be the short time span of the Aterian, that these populations in North Africa had contributed very much to out of Africa and to out of Africa migrations. But now that we know that those populations, those Aterian populations, lived for a period of well over 100,000 years, that the initial dating goes back to at least 145,000 years, we're getting a picture of much more stable populations, and those much more stable populations may not have gone extinct, but they may have gone on to contribute heavily to the out-of-Africa migrations.
More about this new evidence. You said there were new dating techniques. Are there any new discoveries that are also supporting this view?
There's new discoveries, and there are new analyses of old discoveries, and particularly of the fossils. So one of the things that we talk about in our story is the discovery at a site in Morocco called Contrebandier, Smuggler's Cove in English, of a 108,000-year-old child, probably a 7 or 8-year-old child. And one of the reasons that this discovery is very exciting to the researcher is that the child has very big molars. Now, big molars are a feature of Aterian fossil specimens, and a number of them have been found, skulls and other parts of the skeleton. And they're almost routinely characterized by these very big molars, molars much bigger than what we have, you know, what modern humans have today. And you see that these big molars, and other features too, of the other facial features and brow ridges and other aspects of the skull in these Aterian specimens, you see this not only across North Africa, but also in some of the early modern humans that got into Israel. And you also see it, and this is a little bit more controversial and is somewhat debated, but you also see it in the very earliest known modern human to have reached Europe. And this is at a site called Oase in Romania, where we have a 40,000-year-old skull and a 40,000-year-old jaw. And lo and behold, in that 40,000-year-old jaw, we have very big teeth. So this is not direct evidence, it's somewhat circumstantial evidence, but a number of researchers who do believe that North Africa should be considered very important in the scheme of things in modern human evolution see an evolutionary connection, or at least a potential evolutionary connection, between these Aterian big-tooth specimens and this very early big-tooth specimen in Romania.
Are there any naysayers to this evidence and this new hypothesis for how our ancestors spread?
Yes, there are, definitely. One naysayer who I quote in the story is Eric Trinkaus at Washington University in St. Louis, who believes that the special features of the Oase skull, he has studied it together with his colleagues, are due to admixture between modern humans and Neanderthals. Now, that's a minority view at this point, but Trinkaus and other researchers, too, are not quite ready to accept that North Africa was anything other than a dead end. But even some of the naysayers do think that North Africa really bears watching. And one very, very important new category of evidence that is changing our view of the North Africans and the Aterians has to do with the redating of archaeological sites and fairly recent discoveries of symbolic behavior at a number of North African sites. So what we have particularly are personal ornaments made of snail shells. The genus is called Nassarius. And these are found in South Africa. They're found in East Africa, the same genus of snail shells, which were apparently strung as beads in necklaces, are found in other parts of Africa. But in North Africa, the new dating and the new archaeological discoveries are telling us that they show up in North Africa earlier, apparently, than they show up anywhere else. So that the kind of symbolic modern behavior, which archaeologists consider to be key to the evolution of modern humans, to the evolution of modern behavior, and to the creation of the kind of social networks that were necessary for humans to go on the move, all the while keeping in touch with each other. Some of the earliest evidence for that is now showing up in North Africa. And I think it's that kind of evidence that is really turning the head of researchers who are working on modern human sites throughout Africa and even in Europe and Asia, that North Africa was not just kind of a Johnny-come-lately or just kind of a backwoods of modern human evolution, but that some of the most important developments were happening right there and happening right there very, very early.
Michael Balter, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Science contributing correspondent Michael Balter reports in this week's issue on the growing evidence that North Africa was the original home of the modern humans who first trekked out of the continent. Now, Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Graham with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now. Happy New Year, Lauren.
Happy New Year, Rob.
So you've given me a bit of a preview, and I understand this first story is about fighting global climate change by eating bugs. How exactly does that work?
Well, a lot of people choose to eat local food because they think they're reducing their carbon footprint because the food doesn't have to travel very far. And, you know, a lot of people are interested in finding ways to eat that's more environmentally friendly. Well, it turns out that the most environmentally friendly way to eat meat is actually to eat bugs. And there's some people who have actually put some hard numbers on this.
Is it something about the bugs themselves? I mean, they still have to consume.
It's actually, these researchers specifically looked at which greenhouse gases they gave off and how much and how that compared to cows and pigs. So they looked at 5 species of insects, including mealworms and house crickets, and measured the output of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, which are 3 greenhouse gases. And it turns out that all 5 and 6 species, pound for pound, gave off much less greenhouse gases than cattle. And 4 out of the 5 bugs did better than pigs. So it turns out that if you really are environmentally conscious and want to eat in a way that's good for Mother Earth, you should go for mealworms because they churn out less than 1% as much greenhouse gas as cows. And house crickets pollute even less. So those are a good option too.
What accounts for the difference? Something about the bug's metabolism or what?
Well, yes, because cows spend a lot of energy keeping themselves warm, whereas bugs use more of their energy to plump up.
So the numbers are there in terms of at least the pound for pound comparison. What about the environmental impact of raising that many bugs compared to the environmental impact of raising the cows and pigs that we do today?
Well, that's a question that remains to be answered. You have to take into account everything that goes into raising a cow versus raising a grasshopper, especially in the amounts that grasshoppers would need to be raised in order to make a meal. So that's something that these researchers say they're going to look into.
Have you ever tried a cricket burger?
I can't say I have, but this researcher says that they have excellent structure and flavor and that mealworms are pretty good in a quiche.
Okay. Yuck. Well, thanks, Lauren. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, from crickets and mealworms, let's now turn to bumblebees. And this is a sad story because it turns out that we've lost a lot of our bumblebees in the past century. And the evidence for that is a new study that looked at the abundance of bumblebees historically and then went out and tried to find the abundance nowadays. And it turns out there's a drastic difference for many of these species.
Are these declines all around the world or in one particular place?
The researchers were focusing on the U.S., but they've also seen bumblebee declines in the U.K. They think because they destroyed a lot of the hedges between fields in order to make bigger fields, and they think that, you know, they were destroying bumblebee habitat, and that's why they have fewer there.
Is there any understanding now that this decline's been measured about what's causing the decline in the U.S., if not a habitat loss?
Well, there's a certain parasite that's plagued bumblebees in Europe. And they did find that the rate of infection was much higher in populations of dwindling species and not so bad for species that were stable. So they think that this could be part of the reason, but they say that there has to be more research into that to pin it down.
And so what's the next step?
Well, the next step is to really nail down the cause. And, you know, three of the four declining species were closely related, so it could be that they have the same genetic susceptibility to this particular parasite. So that's an argument for the parasite being the cause. The parasite might have come to the U.S. in bees from Europe that were imported to try to raise the numbers of bumblebees in the U.S., which is kind of ironic because then the solution to the declining population of bees could actually be part of the ongoing problem. So breeders who raise these bees, which are so important because of the pollinating they do and the fact that they're kind of sturdier than honeybees and can fly through rougher weather, they really need to make sure that their facilities are disease-free if we want to protect the bees from this parasite and start increasing their numbers again.
Okay, so last one. What's this last one about?
Well, this last story is about something that biomedical researchers have been looking for a long time, and that's something called a biomarker for a disease. So the idea is that no matter where the disease is in the body, it leaves traces in the blood. And it would be really great if you could just, you know, test blood to see if someone had Alzheimer's, for example.
What are these biomarkers?
Well, in this case, the researchers were looking at antibodies, which the immune system churns out when there's a bacteria or a virus present. It turns out that autoimmune and other type of diseases also generate antibodies. So those antibodies could potentially be used as a biomarker for those diseases.
So do researchers know which antibodies to look for in the blood for these various diseases like Alzheimer's, say?
They don't, and that's what makes this problem so difficult. So there's one strategy, which is figure out exactly which molecule produces the antibodies so that you know which ones to look for. But this group kind of took the strategy of throw everything at the blood and see what sticks. So they basically took, you know, 15,000 synthetic proteins that had been used in drug development and looked to see which antibodies they bound to in the blood of people with lupus or Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and things like that. And they actually had a good result for Alzheimer's disease. They found two antibodies at high levels in six people with Alzheimer's. And when they looked at the blood of people with Parkinson's or lupus, they didn't find these antibodies. And they also found it in 16 other Alzheimer's patients. So these two antibodies could be a potential biomarker.
And so these antibodies weren't found in high levels in healthy people?
Well, they had 16 healthy controls, and it also turned up in high numbers in two of them. So that could mean that these biomarkers aren't specific to Alzheimer's, but it turns out that the two people with these elevated antibody levels were older women. So it could be that they actually have early Alzheimer's, but the researchers don't really know. But there's another complication to this, because as people get older, their immune systems produce a lot more dysfunctional antibodies. So it could just be that these people are old, and that's why they have these elevated levels.
Is there a history of this type of technique working?
Actually, biomarker research has a pretty poor record. So this could be yet another kind of false trail. But the researchers have formed a company to really look into it and try to develop it. And they're really excited about it. So there's hope.
With the idea that if you can identify early stages of Alzheimer's better, you might be able to do something better to prevent it.
One would hope, but unfortunately there aren't any treatments for Alzheimer's right now. But that could change in the future. So then it would be really good to know, you know, early on whether you had Alzheimer's so that you could get treatment faster.
Okay. Well, thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Grimm with a selection of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills. Happy New Year, Jennifer.
Happy New Year, Rob. This month, we start with a letter calling further attention to the eco-certification of Antarctic toothfish. This was the subject of a September 24th News Focus story by Eric Stockstead, titled Behind the Eco-Label, A Debate Over Antarctic Toothfish, in which he described the eco-certification by the Marine Stewardship Council a rapidly growing nonprofit based in London, whose label means that the fishing operation doesn't catch so many fish that it jeopardizes the stock. Environmental organizations have objected to the sustainability claims of three fishing companies who want to market the Antarctic toothfish as sustainable and were on track to get the eco-certification label from the Marine Stewardship Council.
Louise Blight of the University of British Columbia and 32 colleagues from around the world write in to identify themselves as some of the scientists who object to the eco-certification of the Antarctic toothfish, which lives in the Ross Sea, one of the most pristine marine ecosystems in the world. The authors write, "The public perceives a certification by the Marine Stewardship Council, or MSC, to mean an environmentally friendly fishery, not one characterized by the dearth of key data, as indicated in the article. Significant data deficiencies lead us to conclude that an eco-friendly label for this fishery is scientifically indefensible."
The authors conclude, "As with MSC-certified fisheries elsewhere, toothfish certification requires that industry eventually provide missing biological data. However, the harsh Antarctic environment makes data collection painstaking and often prohibitively expensive. Thus, such expectations are unrealistic for a commercially viable fishery. Instead of a certification that lacks proper data, a moratorium should be placed on further Ross Sea fishing until the quality of science at least equals that of certified fisheries elsewhere."
You can read the full letter in the December 3rd issue of Science. Our next letter is from the December 10th issue and is about global climate change. Ingrid Burke of the University of Wyoming writes, "Almost certainly, as individuals, scientists are responsible for an order of magnitude more greenhouse gas emissions than the average global citizen, in large part due to travel associated with our scientific interactions, presentations, and service to the scientific community. We warn about the serious consequences of business as usual with respect to greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, yet we ourselves have failed to make necessary changes. Science funding agencies and scientific societies should be the leaders in reducing greenhouse gas emissions from travel."
Acknowledging that there is undeniably great value in personal interactions at scientific meetings, Burke writes, "Scientists should explore ways to facilitate those productive collaborations without requiring travel. Science funding agencies can develop technological solutions to substitute for face-to-face panels and committee meetings. Social scientists can focus on maximizing our effectiveness in scientific interactions over video teleconferencing. Funding agencies can encourage proposals that incorporate video conferencing equipment rather than large travel budgets. Scientific societies can develop strategies for less frequent national meetings, perhaps alternating with regional meetings and advancing web conferencing models."
Burke concludes, "Scientists must lead the charge against business as usual by demonstrating a different way of doing business. The technology is available, and it is time for us to find ways to promote scientific progress without contributing so substantially to the climate change problem we study."
To find out whether our readers agreed with Burke and were willing to make the trade-off she discussed, we posted a readers' poll. The question: would you participate in an annual meeting remotely via video teleconferencing or other technology in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Although not a scientific poll, the results may be encouraging for environmentalists. The largest share of respondents said yes, they would attend an annual meeting remotely, noting that the meeting would lose some value to them, but the trade-off would be acceptable given the environmental benefits. You can read Burke's full letter and the poll in the December 10th issue of Science. Find the full results of the poll by going to the online version of the December 10th issue.
Our final letter is from the December 17th issue and gives credit to China for trying to deal with overpopulation. This was the subject of a September 17th news focus story by Mara Vistendahl titled, "Has China Outgrown Its One-Child Policy?" in which she explored the consequences of China's fertility policies. Overall, writes Jeremy Nathans of the Johns Hopkins Medical School, the story presents the one-child policy in a negative light, buttressed by statistical data, such as the current gender ratio of 119 to 100 at birth, men to women, and the projected graying of the Chinese population. These data are accurate, but incomplete.
Nathans writes, the single most relevant statistic is one that drove the original decision to implement the policy, the total population of China as a function of time. Even with the reduced population growth that came with the one-child policy, and with China's rapid shift toward an urbanized and export-driven economy, those numbers are sobering. In 1960, China had a population of 646 million. In 1980, it was 981 million. By 2000, it had grown to 1.267 billion, and in 2010, it is projected to be 1.354 billion.
Nathans concludes, in the past 50 years, China's population has increased by an amount equal to or greater than the population of all of Central and North America. Without defending or criticizing the one-child policy, we can at least recognize that it stands as a brave attempt by the inhabitants of an overcrowded planet to create a more livable future for our children and grandchildren.
You can find the full letter in the December 17th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the January 7th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.